All right, remember, the machine knows if you're lying. First statement, Carvana will give you a real offer on your car all online.
False.
True, actually. You can sell your car in minutes.
False? That's gotta be...
True again. Carvana will pick up your car from your door, or you can drop it off at one of their car vending machines.
Sounds too good to be true, so true.
Finally caught on. Nice job. Honesty isn't just their policy, it's their entire model. Sell your car today, too.
Carvana.
Pickup fees may apply.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now, get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Hey guys, this right here is going to be a longer episode. It's about an hour long, and it covers coronary artery disease and chronic stable angina. It does not go over heart attacks, NSTEMIs, STEMIs, basically your ACS or acute coronary syndrome. It does not cover that in this particular section. That will be covered in our program for medical surgical 2 or critical care in some programs in the United States. So be mindful with the AI host, again, with the hashtag tag thing or the calling certain things the wrong name, like they call the inferior and superior vena cava, cava. So the inferior, superior vena cava. It's weird, but get over it. It's not perfect. But regardless, just be mindful of weird stuff like that. But the information is still spot on. It's coming straight from the book. So, and the PowerPoints that the instructor uploaded. So it's really good material. And I hope that you find some value out of this stuff. And so I hope that you enjoy the chronic stable angina and coronary artery disease from the Lewis Medical Surgical Nursing Textbook, the 12th edition.
Patient's here.
Oh, boy, got some blood going.
Yeah, there's never blood.
Oh, he's wearing it, too.
Welcome to the bay. When you get over to the bed, we'll go ahead and give you the story. This is all going to happen super fast. Welcome to the emergency room.
70-year-old female, single driver of a vehicle. Appears that she went off-road into a ditch, rolled over her car onto a trailer, caved in the top of the vehicle, was caved in, so she was hanging out partially from the window.
For 45 minutes of CPR, no return circulation. We can stop CPR. 6 over.
Welcome back to The Deep Dive. Our goal here is always to, you know, cut through the noise of overwhelming clinical information and really focus on the crucial, actionable stuff you need to know.
That's right.
And today, we're tackling a really big one. Coronary artery disease, or CAD, and its main chronic sidekick, stable angina. We've got a mountain of source material here. Patho, drugs, interventions, clinical pearls, the whole nine yards.
It's a huge topic and honestly incredibly important. CAD is still the number one killer in the U.S. So understanding it inside and out is, well, it's essential.
Mm-hmm.
Our mission today is basically to boil all this down into a really solid reference guide for you. Yeah. Something that goes beyond just cramming for an exam, something you can actually use long term to understand the why behind the what.
Exactly. And just to be super clear up front, we're focusing on the chronic side of things today, like asymptomatic CAD and chronic stable angina.
Right.
It's really important to draw that line right away between this and acute coronary syndrome, ACS, you know, unstable angina, MI, that's the emergency.
That's the code blue situation, yeah.
What we're diving into is the more predictable ischemia that comes from those fixed blockages. We want to connect the dots from the inflammation all the way to the therapies.
Okay, sounds like a plan. Let's jump right in, starting at the very beginning. atherosclerosis. How does this whole process actually get started?
Atherosclerosis. Even the word itself kind of tells the story, doesn't it? If you break it down.
It really does. It comes from Greek ather, meaning fatty mush, which is, well, descriptive. And scleros, meaning hard. So fatty mush that gets hard, it's literally hardening of the arteries. It starts as these soft, fatty deposits, and then over years, they just calcify and harden up.
And when that hardening, those atheromas, happens specifically in the coronary arteries, the ones feeding the heart muscle, that's when we call it coronary artery disease, CAD.
Precisely. And you'll see a bunch of different names for it, like ASHD, CVHD, IHCHD. Don't let that throw you off.
Right.
They all basically mean the same underlying problem in those heart vessels.
So what kicks it all off? What's the first domino to fall?
It starts with endothelial injury. The endothelium is that super smooth, normally non-sticky inner lining of the artery. It's supposed to let blood just zip right through.
Like Teflon.
Kind of, yeah. But when it gets damaged, it loses that property. It becomes reactive, sticky, and that's the opening for the whole disease process to start.
What kind of things cause that initial damage?
It's usually the stuff we unfortunately see a lot of. Chronic exposure to toxins, like from smoking, high levels of lipids in the blood, hyperlipidemia, the constant wear and tear from high blood pressure, that shearing force. Mm. Then you have inflammation from things like diabetes, other chronic conditions, even some toxins. Once that lining is breached, it starts attracting inflammatory cells, platelets, and the trouble begins.
And this damage then progresses through distinct stages, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it starts alarmingly early.
Yeah, that's the really sobering part. Stage one is the fatty streak. These are the absolute earliest lesions, basically just collections of lipid-filled, smooth muscle cells under the endothelium. They look kind of yellowish.
And you said these can show up?
They can start appearing in coronary arteries as early as age 20.
Wow.
The sort of silver lining here, if there is one, is that this stage might be reversible, or at least significantly slowed down if you aggressively lower LDL cholesterol early on.
Okay, so early intervention matters, even at that stage. But if that doesn't happen, it moves to stage two.
Correct. Stage two is the fibrous plaque. This usually starts showing up by age 30, sometimes earlier. It's a more progressive change. LDL cholesterol keeps infiltrating the vessel wall.
Yeah.
Those LDLs, along with growth factors released locally, stimulate the smooth muscle cells in the artery wall to multiply and migrate. The wall thickens up. Then collagen forms a fibrous cap over that fatty streak.
So it's like scar tissue forming over the fatty deposit.
Kind of, yeah. It forms this firm, grayish or whitish plaque. And this is the real mechanical problem now. It physically narrows the lumen of the artery.
Right.
Reducing blood flow downstream, especially when the heart needs more oxygen, like during exercise.
Which brings us to stage three. The complicated lesion. This sounds like where things get really dangerous.
This is definitely the danger zone. It's where chronic, stable disease can suddenly become acute. The plaque becomes unstable.
What makes it unstable?
Continued inflammation within the plaque itself. This can lead to the fibrous cap thinning, ulcerating, or just outright rupturing.
Okay.
When that cap breaks, the body sees it as an injury, like a cut. And what does the body do when there's an injury?
It tries to form a clot. Platelets rush in.
Exactly. Platelets aggregate at the site, trying to heal the rupture. But in this narrow diseased artery, that clot, that thrombus, can easily block off the remaining space.
And that's where those GPI-beta receptors become critical, right? You mentioned them as the molecular glue.
Absolutely critical. Yeah. Think of these GPI-beta receptors as docking stations on the surface of platelets. For platelets to really clump together effectively and form a solid plug, they need to be linked by fibrinogen. Fibrinogen acts like the bridge, and it connects to these GPI-beta receptors on adjacent platelets.
So the receptors are the attachment points for the bridges.
Precisely. When that plaque ruptures, these receptors get activated en masse. Fibrinogen locks in, linking platelets together, and boom, you get rapid thrombus formation. It can quickly occlude the entire vessel. That's the MI.
Which explains why, in an acute situation, we use drugs that specifically block those receptors. We're trying to break those bridges.
Exactly. It's a race against the body's own, albeit misguided in this case, clotting mechanism.
Now, the body does have a backup plan, though, doesn't it? Collateral circulation.
It does, and it's pretty amazing. Collateral circulation refers to these tiny pre-existing connections, anastomoses between small branches of the coronary arteries.
They're already there.
Yeah, they're normally too small to carry much blood. But they have the potential to grow, to enlarge, essentially creating natural bypasses around a blockage.
What makes them grow?
Two main things. One is just an inherited ability for angiogenesis growing new blood vessels. Some people are just better at it, but the more common trigger is the presence of chronic ischemia.
Ah, so the lack of oxygen signals the need for new roots.
Exactly. If a blockage develops really slowly over many years or decades, that creates a constant low-level ischemia. This gives the collateral vessels time to gradually enlarge.
Okay.
And they can sometimes develop enough capacity to supply adequate oxygen to the heart muscle, at least when the person is at rest.
This explains so much. It's why you might see a patient with a, say, 90% blockage, who only gets winded walking upstairs.
Right.
While someone else with a sudden 60% blockage from a ruptured plaque has a massive heart attack.
That's the key clinical reasoning pearl right there. Slow chronic ischemia allows time for compensation via collaterals. Acute occlusion doesn't. The backup system can't develop overnight. So a sudden blockage, even if technically less severe percentage-wise, can be much more devastating symptomatically. It really highlights why slowing the progression of the disease is so critical.
Okay, understanding the progression naturally leads us to thinking about prevention and risk factors.
Oh.
Let's start with the ones we can't change, the non-modifiable ones.
Right. These are the factors we have to account for in risk assessment, but, well, they are what they are. First is age. Risk goes up significantly for men over 45 and women over 55. After menopause, women's risk catches up fast.
Then gender itself. We often think of heart disease as a man's problem, but...
But it's absolutely not. Heart disease kills almost 10 times more women than breast cancer does. That's a statistic everyone needs to hear.
It really is staggering. And it hammers home why recognizing atypical symptoms in women is so vital. We can't just look for that classic elephant on the chest.
Absolutely not. We'll circle back to those atypical symptoms, but it's a crucial point. Ethnicity also plays a role, for instance. Rates are higher in Black women compared to white women. And then there's genetics. Family history is a big one, contributing maybe 40 to 60% of the overall risk.
Okay, so those are the factors we inherit or can't avoid.
Mm-hmm.
What about the contributing factors? Things like inflammation markers.
Yeah, these are interesting because they give us a window into the underlying process. We're talking about things like C-reactive protein or CRP. High levels indicate inflammation somewhere in the body.
Uh-huh.
And also lipoprotein, LPA, and homocysteine. High levels of these are linked to damaging the vessel lining, promoting plaque, and even affecting clotting.
Are these tested routinely?
Not usually as part of a standard checkup, no. But if someone seems to be at intermediate or high risk based on other factors, or maybe they have CAD despite seemingly controlled lipids, checking these markers can sometimes help clarify the picture. They point towards that chronic inflammatory drive.
So they add context, but the main treatment focus usually stays on the major modifiable risks.
Generally, yes.
Yeah.
They help understand the why sometimes, but the what to do often circles back to lipids, BP, etc. Another area, though, that's getting more attention is psychological states.
Like stress, depression?
Yeah.
How do they physically impact the heart?
It's all about the sympathetic nervous system, the fight or flight response, chronic stress, anxiety, depression, even sustained hostility. They keep that system activated.
Right.
This leads to a constant release of catecholamines, adrenaline, noradrenaline that jacks up your heart rate, raises blood pressure, increases the heart's oxygen demand. Over time, it also messes with blood clotting and promotes inflammation. It's like keeping the engine revving high all the time.
Just wears things out faster.
Pretty much. And we also have to mention substance use, especially stimulants.
Cocaine, methamphetamine.
Hmm. These drugs cause a massive surge in catecholamines. This does two terrible things simultaneously. It dramatically increases the heart's oxygen needs, and it causes potent coronary artery spasm. The arteries literally clamp down.
Ouch.
This combo can trigger ischemia or even a full-blown MI, sometimes even in people with otherwise healthy arteries. It's crucial to consider substance use, especially in younger patients presenting with chest pain or unexplained tachycardia. #TachTech2.2, major modifiable risk factors and management.
Okay, let's pivot to the big levers we can pull, the major modifiable risk factors, starting with the lipids dyslipidemia. What are the key numbers we need to know?
All right, high-yield targets here. Total cholesterol, ideally under 200 mgdl. But the real focus is LDL, the bad cholesterol. We generally want that under 130 mgdl, but honestly, for anyone with known CAD or high risk, the goal is often much lower, sometimes under 100 or even under 70.
That's the stuff that builds up in the arteries.
Exactly. Then there's HDL, the good cholesterol. It helps transport cholesterol out of the arteries, so we want that high. Ideally, above 40 mgdl for men and above 50 mgdl for women.
Okay.
And finally, triglycerides. We want those under 150 mgdl. High triglycerides are often linked with other metabolic problems like diabetes and obesity, but the main pharmacological push is almost always about lowering that LDL.
Got it. Next up, hypertension, high blood pressure. We know stage one starts around 130 over 80. How does that feed into the CAD problem?
It's that shearing stress again. Constantly high pressure batters the delicate endothelial lining. It's like sandblasting the inside of the arteries, causing that initial injury we talked about.
Right, opening the door for plaque.
Precisely. Plus, the heart muscle itself has to work harder to pump against that high resistance. Over time, the main pumping chamber, the left ventricle, can thicken. That's left ventricular hypertrophy. A thicker muscle needs more oxygen, creating a supply-demand mismatch even without blockages. So controlling BP is absolutely fundamental.
Makes sense. And then probably the most damaging lifestyle factor, tobacco use. You called it a double whammy earlier.
It really is. First, the nicotine itself triggers catecholamine release. So increased heart rate, vasoconstriction, higher BP, more workload. Direct stress on the heart.
Okay.
But second, and just as bad, is the carbon monoxide in smoke. CO directly injures the endothelium. And maybe even worse, it binds tightly to hemoglobin in red blood cells, significantly reducing the blood's ability to carry oxygen.
Yes, so you're stressing the heart and reducing its fuel supply at the same time.
Exactly. It's a terrible combination. The good news, if you can call it that, is that quitting smoking has dramatic and relatively rapid benefits. Some of that endothelial damage starts reversing within weeks or months. But quitting is tough. It often requires intensive support.
Definitely. Now, diabetes. The link there is particularly strong and concerning.
It really is. People with diabetes have a 2 to 4 times higher risk of developing CAD. It tends to happen at an earlier age, and they're much more likely to have that silent ischemia we mentioned.
Why is the link so strong?
It's complex, but diabetes causes widespread endothelial dysfunction. The high blood sugar itself is damaging. Plus, it's often associated with abnormal lipid profiles, typically high triglycerides and low HDL and increased inflammation. The goal of diabetics is tight glycemic control, usually aiming for an A1C below 7%.
Okay. And finally, obesity and physical inactivity. We hear about BMI, but also waist circumference. Why the focus on belly fat?
Right. So obesity is generally defined as a BMI over 30. But where you carry the fat matters a lot. Abdominal obesity, the apple shape, defined as a waist circumference over 40 inches in men or 35 inches in women, carries a much higher cardiovascular risk than fat stored primarily in the hips and thighs, the pear shape.
Why is that?
That visceral fat, the fat deep inside the abdomen around the organs, is metabolically very active. It churns out inflammatory substances called adipokines.
Huh?
These promote chronic inflammation systemically, contribute to insulin resistance, raise blood pressure, basically. They directly accelerate the whole atherosclerotic process. So measuring waist circumference gives us important information beyond just BMI.
Good point. And for physical activity, what's the practical advice? The FITT formula?
Yeah, FITT stands for frequency, intensity, time, type. The general guideline is aiming for at least 150 minutes of moderate intensity aerobic activity per week. Think brisk walking, cycling, or 75 minutes of vigorous intensity activity like running or swimming laps.
And how does exercise help specifically with CAD risk?
Multiple ways. It helps manage weight, improves blood pressure and insulin sensitivity. It makes your body better at metabolizing lipids, often raising HDL. It also improves endothelial function and can even decrease the tendency for blood clots to form. It's really a cornerstone of prevention. #2.3 nutritional therapy, specific dietary changes.
Okay, alongside exercise, diet is obviously huge. What are the main dietary goals for tackling CAD risk?
The primary goal is usually lowering that LDL cholesterol. This means focusing on reducing saturated fat and cholesterol intake. Generally, total fat should be around 25 to 35% of total calories, but the type of fat is key.
So less saturated fat, more.
What? More unsaturated fats, monounsaturated, like from olive oil, avocados, nuts, and polyunsaturated fats found in things like fatty fish and certain vegetable oils. These tend to be better for your lipid profile.
And fiber plays a role too, right?
Yeah. Absolutely. Increasing complex carbohydrates, things like whole grains, fruits, vegetables, legumes, boosts your intake of soluble fiber. Soluble fiber actually binds to cholesterol in the digestive tract and helps remove it from the body, which can directly lower LDL levels.
What about people struggling specifically with high triglycerides? Any particular dietary advice there?
Yes. For high triglycerides, the main things to cut back on are alcohol and simple sugars, things like sugary drinks, candy, refined grains. The liver is very efficient at converting excess sugar into triglycerides.
Okay.
And another big recommendation, especially from the American Heart Association, is eating fatty fish like salmon, mackerel, tuna, or sardines at least twice a week.
Why fatty fish?
They're packed with omega-3 fatty acids. Omega-3s have been shown to significantly lower triglyceride levels and may also have other heart benefits, like reducing inflammation and possibly slowing CAD progression. All right, so we've built the foundation of the disease process and risk factors. Now let's look at what happens when that plaque buildup actually causes symptoms, chronic stable angina.
This is the clinical manifestation of that supply-demand mismatch, right?
Exactly. The core mechanism is simple. The heart muscle's demand for oxygen outstrips the supply that can get through those narrowed arteries. This lack of oxygen is ischemia. The pain or discomfort felt is angina, often caused by lactic acid buildup from the muscle working anaerobically.
Is there a certain percentage of blockage that usually triggers symptoms?
Typically, a coronary artery needs to be blocked by about 70% or more before it causes angina during exertion. The exception is the left main coronary artery, the big one that branches off the aorta, because it supplies such a large area of the heart.
Mm-hmm.
A blockage there can cause symptoms or be critically dangerous even at only 50% stenosis.
Okay, so describe the classic picture of stable angina. What should our listener picture?
Think predictable. That's the key word for stable angina. It's usually intermittent chest discomfort, not constant pain. It typically feels like pressure, heaviness, squeezing, or tightness, usually under the breastbone substernal.
And it often radiates.
Yeah, commonly to the jaw, neck, shoulders, or down the left arm, sometimes both arms. It's provoked by activities that increase the heart's workload, physical exertion, strong emotions, sometimes even exposure to cold weather or eating a large meal.
And crucially, how long does it last and what makes it better?
It usually only lasts a few minutes, typically 3 to 5 minutes, maybe up to 10 or 15 at the outside for stable angina. And importantly, it's reliably relieved by rest or by taking sublingual nitroglycerin, SLNTG. That predictability is what defines it as stable.
Got it. But we keep coming back to this, not everyone presents classically. Let's really underscore those atypical symptoms or angina equivalents.
This is so important, especially for women, older adults, and people with diabetes. Instead of that classic chest pressure, they might just feel profound, unusual fatigue, or sudden shortness of breath, dyspnea with minimal exertion,
right,
or nausea, sometimes even vomiting, or discomfort high up in the abdomen in the mid-epigastric area that feels like indigestion or heartburn.
Symptoms that are so easy to brush off or attribute to something else.
Exactly, and that delay in recognition can have serious consequences. Healthcare providers really need to have a high index of suspicion for these atypical presentations, especially in those higher risk groups. Don't just assume it's anxiety or reflux without considering the heart. Hashtag tag 3.2 variations in angina.
Okay, beyond that typical stable pattern, there are a few important variations to know about. Let's start with the one that sounds particularly sneaky, silent ischemia.
Yeah, silent ischemia is exactly what it sounds like. There's objective evidence of myocardial ischemia. You can see it on an ECG as ST depression or T-wave inversion during monitoring or stress testing. But the patient feels absolutely nothing. No pain, no discomfort.
And this is common in diabetics.
Very strongly associated with diabetic neuropathy. The nerve damage from diabetes can essentially blunt or eliminate the pain signals from the heart reaching the brain. The scary part is, even though it's silent, the prognosis is just as bad as symptomatic ischemia if it's not detected and treated. The heart muscle is still being damaged.
Wow. Okay, then there's Prinzmetal's angina. That one sounds different.
It is quite different. Prinzmetal's, or vasospastic angina, is relatively rare. It's caused by a sudden, intense spasm of a major coronary artery. The artery just clamps down, restricting blood flow.
And this isn't necessarily due to plaque.
It can happen in arteries with or without underlying atherosclerosis, though often there's some mild disease present. It typically occurs at rest, often cyclically, sometimes waking people up at night.
Any known triggers?
It's often associated with other vasospastic conditions like migraines or Raynaud's phenomenon. Heavy smoking is a major trigger, and certain substances can provoke it too. The really interesting thing diagnostically is that during an episode, the ECG might show transient ST segment elevation.
Elevation, like an MI.
Exactly, which can be alarming. But in Prinzmetal's, it resolves completely once the spasm breaks, usually with nitrates or calcium channel blockers, which are the mainstays of treatment. Avoidance of triggers is also key.
Okay, and the last variation, microvascular angina.
Right, sometimes called cardiac syndrome X or MVD. This involves chest pain believed to be caused by ischemia in the very small distal branches of the coronary arteries, the microvasculature.
The ones too small to see well on a standard angiogram.
Precisely. So these patients, often women, present with angina symptoms, maybe even have a positive stress test showing ischemia. But when they go for a cardiac catheterization, the large coronary arteries look normal, no significant blockages.
That must be frustrating for them.
Extremely. The pain can be quite severe and prolonged. Treatment often involves the same medications used for regular stable angina nitrates, beta blockers, CCBs, trying to improve flow and reduce demand in those smaller vessels. #TACHTAC3.3, acute care for angina chest pain, immediate intervention.
Okay, let's switch gears to the acute setting. A patient comes in with chest pain, maybe it's their first time, maybe their stable angina pattern has changed. What's the immediate game plan? What are the absolute first steps and the rationale?
The immediate goals are simple: decrease the heart's oxygen demand and or increase the oxygen supply and relieve the pain quickly. It's a sequence.
Okay, step one.
Position upright and apply oxygen. Sitting upright helps reduce preload the amount of blood returning to the heart, which lowers its workload. We give supplemental oxygen, usually via nasal cannula, right away. Even if their O2 saturation seems okay on room air, we want to maximize the oxygen content in the blood that is getting through to the heart muscle.
Makes sense. Step two.
Assessment and monitoring. Get a set of vital signs immediately. Listen to heart and breath sounds. Are there crackles suggesting fluid backup? Is there a new murmur? Get them on a continuous ECG monitor and, crucially, obtain a 12-lead ECG as soon as possible. That 12-lead is key for looking for ST changes, depression, or T-wave inversion suggests ischemia, elevation suggests injury or infarction.
Okay, vital sounds ECG. Step three, pain relief.
Prompt pain relief. First line is sublingual nitroglycerin, NTG, either the tablet or spray. It works fast via vasodilation. Give one dose. Assess their pain level using a 0-10 scale.
What if the first dose doesn't work?
If the pain is unchanged or worse after 5 minutes, you need to assume it might be more than stable angina could be ACS, activate emergency services if outpatient, or the rapid response team is inpatient. You can give a second dose of NTG while waiting and potentially a third dose 5 minutes after the second, up to 3 doses total.
What if NTG isn't cutting it or isn't appropriate?
If NTG fails or isn't enough, the next step is usually IV morphine or another opioid analgesic. Morphine helps with pain, but it also reduces anxiety, which decreases sympathetic drive and lowers oxygen demand. It also causes some venodilation, further reducing preload.
Okay, pain management is key. Then diagnostics.
Diagnostics. Draw blood for cardiac biomarkers. Troponin is the most specific one for heart muscle damage. Also CKMB. These tell us if there's actual cell death, MI. Get a portable chest x-ray to help rule out other causes of chest pain like pneumonia, pneumothorax, or aortic dissection.
And the final, maybe overlooked, step.
Support and reduced anxiety. This is huge. Chest pain is terrifying. A calm, reassuring approach from the nurse or clinician can actually lower the patient's heart rate and blood pressure by reducing that catecholamine surge. Explain what's happening, what you're doing. It makes a real difference.
You mentioned listening for a murmur earlier, that transient systolic murmur.
Yeah.
What does that signify again?
Right. That's a great clinical pearl. If you hear a new systolic murmur, especially at the apex during an episode of chest pain, it might suggest that the ischemia is affecting one of the papillary muscles.
The little muscles that control the mitral valve.
Exactly. If a papillary muscle gets ischemic, it might not work properly, leading to temporary mitral regurgitation blood leaking backward through the valve during systole. That causes the murmur. If the ischemia resolves and the pain goes away, the murmur often disappears too. It's a sign of significant, albeit potentially transient, ischemia. And always, always reassess that pain score after every intervention. Did the NTG help? Did the morphine help? Quantify the effect.
All right, this next section is absolutely critical for anyone studying this topic. The pharmacology of CAD and angina is complex but essential. Let's dive deep into the drug classes, starting with the foundation. Lipid-lowering drugs, #TACHTAC4.1 lipid-lowering drugs, the statins and others.
You got it. And the kings of lipid lowering are the HMG-CoA reductase inhibitors, universally known as statins. Think drugs like atorvastatin, simvastatin, rosuvastatin.
How exactly do they work? What's the mechanism?
They block an enzyme in the liver called HMG-CoA reductase. This enzyme is essential for the liver to make its own cholesterol. By blocking it, the liver produces less cholesterol internally.
Okay, So how does that lower cholesterol in the blood?
Good question. Because the liver cells now have less cholesterol inside them, they compensate by putting more LDL receptors on their surface. These receptors act like little catcher's mitts, pulling LDL cholesterol out of the bloodstream and into the liver for processing. So less liver production plus more clearance from the blood equals lower circulating LDL.
Clever. And rosuvastatin is often mentioned as particularly potent.
Yeah, generally considered one of the most potent in terms of the percentage LDL reduction you can achieve per milligram. Statins also have some other beneficial effects, like stabilizing existing plaques and reducing inflammation, and maybe a minor increase in HDL.
Who absolutely needs to be on a statin based on guidelines? It seems like a lot of people.
It is a broad group. The guidelines generally recommend statins for anyone with established cardiovascular disease, like previous MI, stroke, angina, PCI, CABG.
Mm.
Also, anyone with an LDL level of 190 mgDL or higher.
Okay.
Also, adults aged 40 to 75 with diabetes and an LDL over 70. And finally, adults aged 40 to 75 without diabetes but with an LDL over 70 and an estimated 10-year risk of heart attack or stroke of 7.5% or higher based on risk calculators.
So it covers primary and secondary prevention pretty thoroughly. And it's usually lifelong therapy.
Almost always considered lifelong, yes. Along with diet and exercise, of course. The drugs work best when combined with lifestyle changes.
What are the big side effects or risks we need to monitor for?
Two main things to really watch. First, potential liver damage. Statins are metabolized by the liver, so we monitor liver function tests, LFTs, periodically, especially early in therapy. Second, and maybe more commonly discussed, is muscle injury.
Myalgia.
Yeah, ranging from mild myalgia, just muscle aches or weakness, all the way up to rarely severe muscle breakdown called rhabdomyolysis.
Rhabdo sounds serious.
It is very serious. It's the rapid destruction of skeletal muscle tissue. This releases large amounts of myoglobin into the bloodstream. Myoglobin is toxic to the kidneys and can cause acute kidney injury or failure.
So what are the warning signs for patients?
Any new unexplained muscle pain, tenderness, or weakness, especially if it's severe or accompanied by fatigue or fever, needs to be reported immediately. A key sign of rhabdo is dark, reddish-brown, or tea-colored urine that's the myoglobin spilling out. It's suspected. We check a blood test called creatine kinase, CK, which is released from damaged muscle and usually stop the statin right away.
Okay, crucial monitoring point. What about other lipid drugs beyond statins? Niacin.
Niacin, or vitamin B3, is interesting. It's actually quite effective at lowering triglycerides, and it's the best drug we have for raising HDL cholesterol significantly. It also has a modest LDL lowering effect.
So why isn't it used more often? Raising HDL sounds great.
Well, two reasons. First, the side effects can be really unpleasant. Intense flushing, itching, especially of the face and neck, is very common. GI upset and orthostatic hypotension can also happen. Second, despite raising HDL, large studies haven't consistently shown that adding niacin to a statin actually reduces the risk of heart attacks or strokes further. So its role has diminished quite a bit.
Got it. How about the fibric acid derivatives like gemfibrozil?
Fibrates. Gemfibrozil, fenofibrate, are primarily used to target very high triglyceride levels. They also provide a modest increase in HDL.
Any major concerns with fibrates?
Yes, a big drug alert here. Combining fibrates with statins significantly increases the risk of developing severe myopathy or rhabdomyolysis. So that combination requires very careful consideration and monitoring. Also, gemfibrozil specifically can increase the effects of warfarin, raising the risk of bleeding, so INR needs close monitoring if used together.
Okay, important interactions. Now for the newer, more high-tech options, ezetimibe and the PCSK9 inhibitors.
Right. Ezetimibe, that it works differently, it blocks the absorption of cholesterol from the diet right at the intestinal wall.
So it complements statins.
Exactly. It's often added to a statin when the statin alone isn't getting the LDL low enough. The combination gives you a bigger drop in LDL than increasing the statin dose might.
And the PCSK9 inhibitors, they sound powerful.
They are incredibly powerful. Drugs like eculizumab and ilaricumab are monoclonal antibodies. They target a protein called PCSK9. Normally, PCSK9 binds to LDL receptors on the liver and causes them to be degraded. By blocking PCSK9, these drugs prevent the degradation of LDL receptors. This means many more LDL receptors remain active on the liver surface, pulling huge amounts of LDL out of the blood. They can lower LDL by an additional 50-70% on top of statin therapy.
Wow. Who gets these? They sound expensive.
They are expensive, and they're given by subcutaneous injection every few weeks or monthly. So they're definitely not first line. They're typically reserved for patients with genetic conditions causing extremely high cholesterol, familial hypercholesterolemia, or for patients who truly cannot tolerate statins due to side effects, or those high-risk patients who still have high LDL despite being on maximum statin therapy plus ezetimibe.
Makes sense. A powerful tool for specific situations. And just to recap, for all these lipid drugs, therapy is usually lifelong, requires regular monitoring, and always goes hand in hand with diet and lifestyle.
That's the bottom line. Compliance is key, and lifestyle remains foundational. We usually reassess lipid levels about 4 to 12 weeks after starting or changing therapy to see the effect. #TACTAC4.2 antianginals, nitrates.
Okay, let's move to the drugs that directly target the angina symptoms, the nitrates. How do they provide that quick relief? What's the core mechanism?
Nitrates are potent vasodilators. Their main effect, the one that really relieves angina, is dilation of peripheral veins.
Veins, not arteries primarily.
Primarily veins, yes. Dilating the veins causes blood to pool more in the periphery, so less blood returns to the heart. This reduction in venous return is called decreased preload.
Okay.
Less preload means the heart chambers aren't stretching as much with each beat, so the heart wall tension goes down, and the heart's workload and oxygen demand decrease dramatically. That's the number one effect.
Do they dilate arteries too?
They do cause some dilation of systemic arteries, which reduces afterload, the resistance the heart pumps against, further lowering workload. And importantly, they can dilate coronary arteries and collateral vessels, which can increase oxygen supply to the heart muscle. However, in arteries that are already severely narrowed by fixed plaque, the ability to dilate might be pretty limited. So the preload reduction is really the star of the show for angina relief.
Got it. So for acute attacks, we use the short-acting forms, the sublingual tablet or spray. What's the absolutely critical patient teaching for using SLNTG?
Okay, non-negotiable points. First, the patient must sit down before taking it. Nitrates cause vasodilation, which can lead to a sudden drop in blood pressure and dizziness or fainting, orthostatic hypotension. Sitting minimizes the risk of falling.
Good point. What else?
The tablet should ideally cause a slight tingling or burning sensation under the tongue that tells you it's still potent. They lose potency over time, especially if exposed to heat, light, or air. Keep them in their original dark glass container, tightly capped. Generally, the prescription should be replaced every 6 months.
And the dosing protocol. This is life or death information.
Absolutely. Take one dose, tablet or spray, at the onset of chest pain. If the pain is not improved or is worse after 5 minutes, the patient or family must call 911 immediately. Don't drive to the hospital. Call emergency services.
Why so strict about the 5-minute rule?
Because if nitroglycerin doesn't relieve the pain quickly, it's much more likely to be unstable angina or an actual MI, which requires immediate medical intervention that can't be provided at home. While waiting for EMS, the patient can take a second dose, and if still no relief after another 5 minutes, a third dose. But the crucial first step after 5 minutes of no relief is calling 911.
Okay. Any other key teaching points?
Yes, they can take it prophylactically. If they know a certain activity usually triggers their angina, like walking uphill, sexual activity, they can take a dose 5 to 10 minutes beforehand to try and prevent the pain. And headache is a very common side effect due to cerebral vasodilation, usually managed with acetaminophen.
And the massive drug interaction warning.
The absolute contraindication, nitrates cannot be used with drugs for erectile dysfunction, sildenafil, Viagra, Cadalafil, Cialis, Vardenafil, Levitra, or similar drugs used for pulmonary hypertension.
Why?
Both classes of drugs cause vasodilation through related pathways, nitric oxide and CGMP. Taking them together causes synergistic, profound vasodilation, leading to a potentially catastrophic drop in blood pressure, shock, and even death. Always, always screen for use of these drugs before giving nitrates.
Crystal clear. Now, what about the long-acting nitrates? Things like isosorbide, mononitrate, adenitrate, or the nitroglycerin patch or ointment. These are for prevention, right?
Right. These are used on a scheduled basis to prevent angina episodes from occurring throughout the day.
But they have that tolerance issue you mentioned earlier.
Yes, nitrate tolerance is a major clinical problem. If nitrates are in the system continuously, the blood vessels become less responsive to their dilating effects. The drugs stop working as well.
So how do we prevent that?
To maintain effectiveness, patients using long-acting nitrates must have a daily nitrate-free interval. This is typically a 10 to 14-hour period where they don't have the drug on board.
How is that practically managed?
For patches, they're usually applied in the morning and removed in the evening, leaving the skin clear overnight. For oral long-acting pills, the dosing schedule is adjusted. Also, doses given early morning and mid-afternoon, but not at bedtime, to create that overnight drug-free window.
That seems counterintuitive, leaving them unprotected overnight.
It does, but it's necessary for the drug to keep working during the day when they're more active. We generally schedule the nitrate-free period overnight because cardiac workload is typically lowest during sleep. If someone has significant nocturnal angina, managing tolerance becomes trickier and might require adjusting the schedule or adding other meds.
Any specific handling instructions for the topical forms?
Yes. For the ointment, paste, or patches, anyone applying them should wear gloves to avoid absorbing the medication through their own skin, which could cause headache or hypotension in the caregiver. Also, never apply a patch over hairy areas, broken skin, or scars. Rotate sites. And crucially, remove any nitrate patch before defibrillation or cardioversion. The electricity can arc through the metal foil backing and cause burns. #4.3 angina modifiers, ACERRBs, beta blockers, CCBs, ranolazine.
Okay, beyond nitrates, we have several other classes that modify angina or the underlying CAD process. Let's start with ACE inhibitors and ARBs. We usually think of them for blood pressure or heart failure. What's their role in stable angina?
ACE inhibitors like lisinopril and allopril and ARBs like Lisartan and Valsartan are recommended for many patients with stable angina, especially if they also have other conditions. The big indications are an ejection fraction, EF, of 40% or less, hypertension, diabetes, or chronic kidney disease, CKD.
Even if their EF is normal?
Yes, even with normal EF, guidelines suggest using them if the patient has stable angina plus diabetes and at least one other CAD risk factor.
What benefits do they provide in this context?
They do lower blood pressure, which reduces cardiac workload, but perhaps more importantly, especially post-MI or in heart failure, they help prevent or reverse ventricular remodeling. That's the damaging changes in the heart's size, shape, and structure that occur after injury or chronic strain. They basically help preserve heart function long-term. ARBs are typically used if someone can't tolerate an ACE inhibitor, usually because of that persistent dry cough or, rarely, angioedema.
Got it. Now, the beta-adrenergic blockers, these seem like absolute workhorses in CAD management.
They really are. Drugs like metoprolol, carvedilol, bisoprolol are cornerstones. Their primary benefit in angina comes from decreasing myocardial oxygen demand.
How do they do that?
They block the effects of adrenaline and noradrenaline, catecholamines, on the heart's beta-1 receptors. This leads to a decreased heart rate, lower blood pressure, reduced SVR, and reduced myocardial contractility, the force of a contraction. Basically, they make the heart beat slower and less forcefully, significantly reducing its workload and oxygen needs.
Are they just for symptom relief, or do they offer more?
They definitely relieve angina symptoms, but certain beta blockers, specifically carvedilol, metoprolol succinate, and bisoprolol, have also been shown to reduce the risk of death in patients who've had an MI or have heart failure with reduced EF. So for those patients, they are continued indefinitely for survival benefit, not just angina control. They're also first-line therapy for controlling heart rate in patients with coexisting atrial fibrillation.
You mentioned selectivity earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that important with beta blockers?
Right. Beta blockers can be cardioselective, primarily blocking beta-1 receptors, which are mostly in the heart, or non-selective, blocking both beta-1 and beta-2 receptors found in the lungs, blood vessels, etc.
Examples.
Metoprolol and atenolol are examples of cardioselective ones. Propranolol is a classic non-selective one.
Why does it matter?
Because blocking beta-2 receptors in the lungs can cause bronchoconstriction. So non-selective beta blockers should generally be avoided or used with extreme caution in patients with asthma or severe COPD, as they can trigger an attack. Cardioselective agents are usually preferred in those patients, although even they can lose some selectivity at higher doses.
Okay, good distinction. What are the main contraindications or cautions?
They shouldn't be used in patients with severe bradycardia, very slow heart rate, or acute decompensated heart failure, when the heart failure is suddenly much worse. They can also mask some of the warning signs of hypoglycemia, low blood sugar in diabetics, like tachycardia and palpitations, though sweating might still occur. Patients need to be aware of that.
And the big teaching point about stopping them?
Never stop beta blockers abruptly, especially in patients with known CAD. Doing so can lead to a dangerous rebound effect.
What happens?
The receptors that were being blocked suddenly become exquisitely sensitive to circulating catecholamines. This can cause a sudden surge in heart rate and blood pressure, leading to a dramatic increase in the frequency and intensity of angina attacks, and potentially triggering an MI or dangerous arrhythmias. They must be tapered off slowly under medical supervision if they need to be discontinued.
Okay, that's a critical safety point. Now, if beta blockers aren't suitable or aren't enough, we move to calcium channel blockers, CCBs.
Correct. CCBs are often used when beta blockers are contraindicated, like in severe asthma or bradycardia, or if angina persists despite beta blocker therapy. They are also the drugs of choice for treating Prinzmetal's vasospastic angina.
How do they work for angina?
They block the entry of calcium into smooth muscle cells in blood vessels and or heart muscle cells. This leads to several effects. Systemic vasodilation, lowering SVR and BP, reducing afterload. Coronary vasodilation, potentially increasing O2 supply. And decreased myocardial contractility, reducing O2 demand. Some CCBs also slow the heart rate.
You mentioned some CCBs slow the heart rate. There are different types.
Yes, two main classes. The dihydropyridines, like amlodipine, Norvasc, and nifedipine, Procardia. These are primarily potent vasodilators. They have less effect on heart rate and contractility. Because of the strong vasodilation, side effects like headache, flushing, and peripheral edema, ankle swelling, are common.
Okay, and the other class?
The non-dihydropyridines, which are verapamil, Kalan, and diltiazem. Cardizem. These have more pronounced effects on the heart itself. They slow the heart rate significantly by acting on the SA and AV nodes and decrease contractility in addition to causing vasodilation.
So non-dihydropyridines might be better if you also want heart rate control.
Exactly. But they need to be used cautiously with beta blockers because the combined effect on heart rate and contractility can be excessive, potentially leading to severe bradycardia or heart block.
Any unique side effects to know? You mentioned verapamil earlier.
Yes, verapamil is notorious for causing severe constipation. It relaxes the smooth muscle in the gut quite effectively. Patients need to be warned and may need stool softeners or laxatives. Also, both verapamil and diltiazem can increase the levels of digoxin if taken concurrently, so digoxin levels need monitoring.
Good to know. And the last drug in this modifier category, ranolazine, Ranexa.
Ranolazine is kind of unique. It's a late sodium current inhibitor. It's used for chronic angina that hasn't responded adequately to other therapies. It's often added on to other anti-anginal meds.
What's its advantage?
Its main advantage is that it reduces angina symptoms without significantly affecting heart rate or blood pressure. This makes it a useful option for patients who already have low BP or slow heart rate and can't tolerate higher doses of beta blockers or CCBs.
Any major downsides or warnings?
The main concern with ranolazine is that it can prolong the QT interval on the ECG. A prolonged QT interval increases the risk of a dangerous ventricular arrhythmia called torsades de pointe. Therefore, it needs to be used cautiously, especially with other drugs that also prolong the QT interval, like certain antibiotics, antifungals, antipsychotics.
Okay, we've covered the disease process, risks, and a ton of pharmacology. Now, how do we actually diagnose the extent of CAD? And decide on interventions like stents or bypass surgery. #5.1 diagnostic studies.
When someone presents with symptoms suggestive of angina, the initial workup usually includes that 12-lead ECG we talked about, comparing it to previous ones if available. We'll draw cardiac biomarkers like troponin to rule out an acute MI. A lipid profile and maybe CRP level give us risk factor information. A chest X-ray helps exclude other causes.
Then if it doesn't look like an acute MI, we move to stress testing.
Usually, yes. Stress testing is key for diagnosing stable angina and assessing risk. The goal is to safely stress the heart, either through exercise on a treadmill or chemically using drugs like adenosine or dobutamine if the person can't exercise adequately.
What are we looking for during the stress test?
We monitor the ECG continuously for ischemic changes, typically ST segment depression. We also monitor blood pressure response and, importantly, ask the patient about any symptoms they experience. Sometimes imaging is combined, like echocardiography, stress echo, or nuclear imaging, SPECT or PET scans, to actually visualize how different parts of the heart muscle are functioning and perfusing under stress.
What makes a stress test positive or abnormal?
Generally, significant ST depression on the ECG during stress, reproduction of the patient's typical chest pain, abnormalities on the imaging showing areas of poor blood flow, perfusion defects, or poor wall motion, or sometimes an abnormal blood pressure response, like a drop in systemic BP with exertion. A positive test strongly suggests significant underlying CAD, typically blockages over 70% or 50% in the left main.
And if the stress test is positive or the symptoms are highly suspicious, the next step is often the gold standard, cardiac catheterization.
Correct. Cardiac catheterization, or coronary angiography, provides the definitive diagnosis. A catheter is inserted, usually via the radial artery in the wrist or the femoral artery in the groin, and threaded up to the heart. Contrast dye is injected directly into the coronary arteries and X-ray images, angiograms are taken.
What does the cath show us?
It allows us to see exactly where the blockages are, how severe they are, the percentage of stenosis, and the overall anatomy of the coronary arteries. This information is crucial for deciding the best treatment strategy, continued medical management, PCI with stents, or CABG surgery. A cath is usually only done if the patient is considered a potential candidate for revascularization based on their symptoms or stress test results. Hashtag #TagTag 5.2 percutaneous coronary intervention, PCI.
Okay, so if the cath shows suitable blockages, often the intervention performed right then and there is PCI. What does that involve?
PCI usually starts with balloon angioplasty. A catheter with a small balloon on the tip is guided to the blockage. The balloon is inflated, compressing the plaque against the artery wall and widening the lumen.
Just the balloon, or something usually left behind?
Almost always, after the balloon opens the vessel, a stent is deployed. A stent is a small, expandable mesh tube, usually made of metal alloy. It's mounted on a balloon catheter, positioned at the site of the blockage, and expanded by inflating the balloon. The balloon is then removed, leaving the stent behind to act as a scaffold, holding the artery open.
Now, this is where the stent type becomes incredibly important, right? Bare metal versus drug-eluting.
Absolutely critical distinction. You have bare metal stents, BMS, which are just the plain metal scaffold, and you have drug-eluting stents, DES, which are coated with a medication.
What's the purpose of the drug coating on DES?
The main problem with early stents, the BMS, was instant restenosis, ISR. The body sometimes saw the metal stent as an injury and reacted by causing excessive scar tissue, neointimal hyperplasia, to grow over and inside the stent, eventually narrowing the artery again.
Okay.
The drugs on DES, like everolimus, sirolimus, are specifically designed to inhibit that scar tissue growth, dramatically reducing the rate of restenosis compared to BMS.
So DES sound much better. Why would anyone use a BMS then?
It comes down to the risk of stent thrombosis and the duration of required antiplatelet therapy. Because the drug on a DES slows down healing and the process of the body's own endothelial cells covering the stent struts, the metal remains exposed to the bloodstream for longer,
making it more prone to clots forming inside the stent.
Exactly. Stent thrombosis is a rare but often catastrophic event, usually causing a large MI or death. To prevent it, patients need potent antiplatelet therapy.
This is the DTaT dual antiplatelet therapy.
Yes. Typically, aspirin plus a P2Y12 inhibitor like clopidogrel, Plavix, Prasugrel, Afint, or Ticagrelor, Brilinta. The duration differs crucially based on stent type.
What's the difference in duration?
For a BMS, where the stent gets covered by endothelium relatively quickly, the risk of late thrombosis is lower. DEPT is typically required for a minimum of only 1 month, although aspirin is usually continued lifelong.
Okay. And for DS?
For DS, because healing is delayed and the thrombosis risk persists longer, DEPT is required for a much longer duration, traditionally a minimum of 12 months, sometimes longer depending on the patient's risk profile. Although newer generation DS have shown safety with shorter durations, sometimes down to 3 or 6 months, particularly if bleeding risk is high, but the standard is still often a year.
So stopping DEPT early, especially with a DES, is incredibly dangerous.
Life-threateningly dangerous. It's one of the most important discharge teaching points after PCI with a DRS. Patients must understand the importance of taking both antiplatelet drugs exactly as prescribed for the full duration, unless explicitly told otherwise by their cardiologist.
During the PCI procedure itself, other anti-clotting meds are used too.
Yes. During the procedure, patients typically receive heparin, unfractionated or low molecular weight, and often a P2Y12 inhibitor loading dose. Sometimes, very potent IV antiplatelet agents called GPI-beta inhibitors might be used in high-risk situations, like if there's a large clot burden.
Okay. What about nursing care immediately after PCI? What are the priorities?
Huge focus on monitoring the access site, whether it was the radial artery or femoral artery. Check frequently for bleeding, hematoma formation, a collection of blood under the skin, swelling. Listen for a bruit or feel for a thrill, which could indicate an arteriovenous fistula or pseudoaneurysm. Keep the patient flat or the wrist straight as ordered.
What else?
Continuous ECG monitoring for any dysrhythmias or signs of recurrent ischemia, like abrupt closure of the stented vessel. Monitor vital signs closely. Assess peripheral pulses and circulation distal to the access site. And monitor renal function, BUN, creatinine, and encourage fluids because the contrast dye used is potentially nephrotoxic. Hashtag #TagTag 5.3 coronary artery bypass graft, CABG surgery.
Okay, PCI isn't always possible or the best option. When does a patient need open heart surgery? a CBG.
CBG surgery is generally indicated for patients with more extensive or complex disease that isn't well suited for stents. Key indications include significant left main coronary artery disease, three vessel disease, blockages in all three major coronary territories, especially if LV function is impaired, or sometimes two vessel disease involving a severe blockage in the proximal LAD artery.
Also, if medical management fails or PCI isn't feasible.
Right. If someone continues to have disabling angina despite maximum medical therapy, or if the blockages are technically difficult for PCI, like very long lesions, heavily calcified plaques, or chronic total occlusions, sometimes it's needed after a failed PCI attempt.
How does CBG work? What vessels are used for the bypass grafts?
The idea is to bypass the blockage by grafting a healthy blood vessel from elsewhere in the body. The graft connects the aorta, the main artery leaving the heart, to a point on the coronary artery beyond the blockage, restoring blood flow.
What vessels do they typically use?
The gold standard graft, especially for bypassing the important LAD artery, is the internal mammary artery, IMA, usually the left one, LIMA. It's an artery that normally runs inside the chest wall.
Why is the IMA so good?
Because it's an artery grafting onto an artery, and it seems naturally resistant to developing atherosclerosis itself. LIMA-collowed grafts have excellent long-term patency rates, often lasting 15, 20 years or more.
What other vessels are used?
The saphenous vein from the leg is very commonly used, especially for bypassing other coronary arteries besides the LAD. It's readily available and long enough for multiple grafts. However, vein grafts are more prone to developing narrowing intimal hyperplasia and eventually failing over time, maybe 5-10 years on average.
Any other options?
The radial artery from the forearm is another option. It's an artery, so patency might be better than vein grafts long-term, but not quite as good as the IMA. The main issue with radial artery grafts is their tendency to spasm postoperatively. Patients usually need to be on calcium channel blockers or long-acting nitrates for several months after surgery to prevent spasm and keep the graft open.
Okay, now the surgery itself. The traditional method involves cracking the chest and using the heart-lung machine.
Right. Conventional CABG involves a median sternotomy, splitting the breastbone, to access the heart. The patient is then placed on cardiopulmonary bypass, CPB, the heart-lung machine. This machine takes over the function of the heart and lungs, circulating and oxygenating the blood while the surgeon operates on a still, quiet heart.
CPB sounds like a major intervention. What are the risks associated with being on pump?
CPB has potential complications. Circulating blood outside the body triggers a systemic inflammatory response. There's increased risk of bleeding and need for transfusions. Fluid shifts and electrolyte imbalances are common. Neurologic complications, ranging from stroke to more subtle cognitive changes, pump head, can occur. And postoperative atrial fibrillation, AFib, is very common after CPB.
Are there techniques to avoid CPB?
Yes. Off-pump CABG, OPCA, is performed on a beating heart. Special stabilizing devices are used to hold the small area of the heart being worked on still, while the rest of the heart continues to beat and circulate blood normally.
What are the advantages of OPCA?
It avoids the complications associated with CPB. Studies suggest potentially less bleeding, less renal dysfunction, maybe fewer neurologic issues, and possibly shorter recovery times, especially in higher-risk patients. However, it's technically more demanding for the surgeon.
And there are even less invasive options. MidCAB.
Right. Minimally invasive direct CEG, MidCAB, is usually done for bypassing just one or two arteries, often the LAD using the LIMA. It avoids the sternotomy, using smaller incisions between the ribs, thoracotomy. It's typically done off pump. There's also TCAB, totally endoscopic coronary artery bypass, which uses robotics through tiny ports. These minimally invasive approaches lead to much faster recovery, but are only suitable for specific types of blockages.
Okay. What about post-op care after CAG, especially in the ICU? What are the priorities?
It's intensive. Continuous monitoring of hemodynamics is key: heart rate, rhythm, blood pressure, usually via an arterial line, central venous pressure, cardiac output if needed. Managing chest tubes is crucial, monitoring drainage amount and character, ensuring patency to prevent fluid buildup around the heart, cardiac tamponade.
Nails?
Preventing and managing dysrhythmias, especially AFib, is a major focus. Beta blockers are usually started early post-op, if possible. Pain management is critical. Sternotomy or thoracotomy incisions are painful, and good pain control is needed for deep breathing, coughing, and mobility. Monitoring for bleeding, managing fluids and electrolytes carefully. Weaning from the ventilator, early mobilization.
You mentioned cognitive changes after CPB, POCD.
Yes, post-operative cognitive dysfunction, POCD. Patients, especially older ones, might experience issues with memory, concentration, or attention for days, weeks, or sometimes even months after major surgery, particularly CIBG involving CPB. It's thought to be related to microemboli, inflammation, or anesthesia effects. It usually improves over time, but it can be very distressing, and patients and families need education and support. Hashtag tag outro. So, wrapping this all up, this deep dive really shows how coronary artery disease boils down to that initial endothelial injury, relentlessly fueled by inflammation and those lipid deposits, from the fatty streak all the way to choosing between a DES or a BMS or deciding between PCI and CABG.
Yeah.
The absolute foundation, the palliative backbone of managing this chronic condition, remains hitting those modifiable risk factors hard. Lipids, blood pressure, smoking cessation, diabetes control, lifestyle, that's where the biggest long-term impact lies.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And for our listener using this as a study guide, the clinical pearls we really want you to take away are, first, always maintain that high index of suspicion for atypical angina symptoms, the fatigue, the nausea, especially in women, the elderly, and diabetics. Don't miss it.
Crucial.
Second, truly understand the why behind DAT duration. Knowing if it was a BMS or DATS isn't just a detail. It dictates life-saving medication adherence. And third, have that acute chest pain protocol down, cold the sequence, the rationale, so you can act confidently and correctly when seconds count.
Well said. We spent a good amount of time today on the dangers of silent ischemia, right? The heart muscle starving for oxygen without sending out a pain signal.
Right, especially in diabetics.
That whole concept of silent disease leads naturally to a final provocative thought for our listeners, connecting to another widespread, often silent cardiovascular threat. We know the heart muscle can silently starve, but our sources also highlight that the heart's electrical system can silently misfire. Up to 30% of atrial fibrillation cases are estimated to be paroxysmal, coming and going, and completely asymptomatic, silent AFib.
And AFib carries a huge stroke risk if it's not treated with anticoagulants.
Exactly. Just like silent ischemia carries the risk of heart damage, silent AFib carries a comparable risk of devastating stroke, precisely because it often goes undetected and untreated. A standard ECG, the kind you get in a doctor's office, is just a 10-second snapshot. It frequently misses intermittent problems like paroxysmal AFib. Yeah. So here's the thought to mull over. If we know that high-risk patients, like those recovering from CABG, or people who've had a stroke with no clear cause, often need extended cardiac monitoring, sometimes for 30 days or more with wearable patches, just to catch these silent AFib episodes, how truly effective are our standard, brief, point-in-time diagnostic checks for picking up these critical silent electrical issues in the broader high-risk cardiac population? Should extended monitoring become more of the default rather than the exception in certain scenarios? Something to think about.
My place in tech changes every day, but I don't fear the future because I'm with the leader, Pluralsight. Their online learning platform has the hands-on, expert-led courses I need to master new tech skills and create bigger impacts so I can learn quickly and stay ahead. With Pluralsight, I don't fear what's next. I embrace it. Tap in at Pluralsight.com and see for yourself.